The next case is 03-814, Reginald Rucker versus Everin Securities, Inc. Ms. Simon.
Good morning. My name is Ellen Simon, and I represent the appellant Reginald Rucker in this case. And, Your Honor, I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Watch your time.
There is one issue and one issue before this court, and that is, did the Court of Appeals err in invoking the parole evidence rule to bar plaintiff's claim? That issue can be and should be simply decided by reaffirming the holding set forth by this court in Klonowski at 109 Ohio State 230. That holding states that where an agreement is made and admitted and evidence is submitted without objection by the parties to sustain their respective positions, the defendants cannot thereafter raise the question that a certain written instrument constituted the contract between the parties and cannot be enlarged, contradicted, or explained by parole evidence. The Klonowski case is on all fours with the present case. It cannot be meaningfully distinguished, and the defendants in their brief have made no attempt to do so. In fact, it is not even mentioned. In addition, whereas in this case, the defendants not only failed to object, but offered the alleged parole evidence to substantiate their position, defendants invited the error, waived the error, and did not properly preserve the issue for appeal. And I cite Setter Ridge Ganley versus Smith at 31 Ohio State versus Stinn, 31 Ohio State, 3rd, 310, and the seven other appellate decisions that are cited on page 13 of our brief. Again, defendants make no effort to distinguish these cases because it cannot be done, nor was any argument made as to why this court should not follow its own precedent. With respect to the merger clause relied upon by the Court of Appeals, we know, as stated in the Trinova case at 70 Ohio State 3rd, 271, that contract integration is a corollary to the parole evidence rule and that it only applies when there is a single and final memorial of the understanding of the parties that contains the whole of the parties' agreement. It should not be applied to independent contracts and never to exclude proof of a promise supported by separate consideration. All of the legal scholars agree on this point. The defendants have not and cannot dispute it. The April 1996 compensation agreement in the present case was signed after the representations were made to Rucker and after Rucker had relied on the representations and changed his position. The promissory estoppel claim was a separate agreement with separate consideration. Under such circumstances, the promissory estoppel claim is not superseded or invalidated by a subsequent integration. Moreover, according to the Restatement of Contracts 216, Section E, a merger or integration clause does not control the question of whether a writing was assented to as an integrated agreement. In fact, the restatement says it is a factor to be considered. As the U.S. Supreme Court has stated in the Blackledge case, quote, even a written contractual provision declaring that the contract contains the complete and final agreement of the parties and that no antecedent or extrinsic representation exists, does not conclusively bar proof that such additional agreement does exist and should be given force. For one, as stated by Corbin, a statement in the writing that it contains all of the agreed upon terms and that there are no promises, warranties, or other extrinsic provisions is a statement of fact which may actually be untrue. The restatement also supports this position in section 218.
Mr. Simon, let's go to this record. As you know, the appellee emphasizes the fact that Mr. Rucker apparently testified that there were two promises made to him. One was that he'd get a loan for $10,000, and that, I take it that, from what I read, that was done, and that he would create this minority investment firm for me. There was a minority investment firm created, was there not?
Yes, there was.
And so, what's left?
Your Honor, the promises that were made to Rucker involved a legitimate minority enterprise which would be eligible to compete for and receive minority set-aside funds. The defendants have admitted that and at pages 1, 2, and 18 of their brief, all of the evidence corroborates that the promise contained a promise that the minority business enterprise would be eligible to compete for minority set-aside funds. That is the scope of the promise, and that is not excluded. Both sides admit that that was the agreement, and those terms are clear and specific. The April 1996 compensation agreement does not mention or address this subject. And as this court has said in Trinova, a subsequent contract does not supersede or modify unambiguous terms in a preceding contract unless the subsequent agreement specifically evidences an intent to do so. Wigmore argued on this point that if the extrinsic negotiation is not mentioned, covered, or dealt with in the writing, then presumably the writing was not intended to cover that element of the negotiation. Farnsworth says if nothing is contained as to the topic, then it is not inconsistent. This court has said,
that there are two separate agreements, the compensation agreement and the minority business agreement. I had a hard time understanding what exactly you allege Everin to have promised that they were responsible for that they didn't do just as to the minority business enterprise. I mean, they created one. What else did they not do?
The promise was not just to create a minority business enterprise. The promise was to create a minority business prize that was legal and legitimate, and
okay.
the objective of which.
What did they do that didn't make it legitimate or whatever? I mean,
the objective is which was to be able to obtain and receive and manage minority set-aside funds.
But I couldn't read and see in the brief what exactly did they do that made it not legal or not eligible. I mean, they applied late, but that seems to be your client's fault every bit as much as anyone else's fault if he's head of this group.
Well,
he's
that's
the one responsible for applying late.
That was denied by Mr. Rucker, by the way.
But
to put
late.
That aside, to answer your question, Your Honor, under the contract which Everin created for it and Rucker Investment Consultants, the clients that were introduced by Rucker were not Rucker clients. They became Everin clients. Under the contract, Everin provided the services, Everin got the income, and Rucker got a commission.
To me, you're wanting to have your cake and eat it too. You want to argue that this agreement, that is compensation, only applies to regular clients that are normal investment clients. And so therefore this agreement shouldn't control. You have the separate agreement that's a minority business enterprise, and they didn't somehow get clients to the minority business enterprise, is that what you're saying? You are saying the $52 million only went to this compensation agreement and was just a regular investment independent contractor thing.
That's not what I'm saying, Your Honor.
Okay.
And I'm going to complete, I don't mean to interrupt you, but I'm going to complete my answer, which will hopefully answer both of your questions. That under the contract, Rucker got a commission, which was the identical commission he received as an employee. Rucker Investment Consultants had no capital, no offices, no equipment, no employees, no technical support, no computers. It owned or leased nothing which would enable it to do the work. It had no separate facilities. At all times,
it had $52 million in accounts, didn't it? Is that
he did not have $52 million. He had $52 million of managed money clients that he brought with him from Dean Witter. They were not minority set aside funds. They have nothing to do with minority set aside funds. He didn't need Rucker Investment Consultants to be incorporated to even have those clients.
Isn't his argument that the structure that Evren gave him, RIC, that they made for him to get the minority account business, that that structure didn't permit him to do that? Where's the evidence that in the record that indicates that the structure that Evren created in the contract that he signed prevented him from getting the workers' comp accounts or whatever?
Okay, I'm completing this answer because
okay.
I was getting there.
Okay.
I'm leading to this.
I didn't mean to take you off here, but
obviously, since the clients were Evren clients under the contract, and Evren provided the services under the compensation agreement, and Evren got the fees or the income, and Evren was not a minority business enterprise, it would not have been entitled, because Evren was not a minority business enterprise, to receive minority set-aside funds. As Felicia Flowers Smith testified, it would be hard to convince public clients that a minority who was paid by Evren, who used Evren's space, who was actually a part of our operation, who used Evren's facilities, Evren's staff, Evren's services, was in fact a separate, autonomous, minority-controlled entity. You can't have a minority-owned business, she said, if you don't control anything, you don't even control your own space. It would simply be a front, which is precisely what Flowers Smith advised her superiors in writing in September of 1995. That's written on Exhibit 31A.
Counsel, I have a process question. If we agree with you that the Court of Appeals committed an error, was wrong on the sole issue that you have presented to us, how do we properly dispose of this case?
You properly dispose of this case by holding that the parole evidence rule did not apply to this case, and that questions pertaining to whether or not the promises were fulfilled were questions of fact for the jury, and questions asked to damages.
I understand
damages
how we answer that question, but
were for the jury,
where
and the
do
verdict
we set,
would be reinstated.
The verdict reinstated,
yes.
Even though the Court of Appeals did not address, they say in their final paragraph, because the trial court erred in not granting the JNOB, the remaining assignments of error regarding irregularities, the trial and request for remitter are moot. So we don't have to send it back.
I do not believe you need to send it back.
Right.
The defendants admitted and acknowledged that Rucker's firm would have to be operated in a manner that was consistent with regulations and guidelines which govern minority-owned businesses. Evren clearly understood that it cannot get contracts unless it agreed to do so. The defendants clearly understood that the minority business had to be a separate, standalone, freestanding entity from the majority joint venture partner.
Counsel, where is your client's responsibility in all this? I mean, this is supposed to be a minority-based enterprise. You keep saying Evren didn't do X, Y, Z. What is your client's responsibility to say, well, gosh, I better go out and get a separate office. I better go out and do X, Y, Z so I do comply because it's my business. Where was his actions in all of this? I'm having a hard time seeing that.
Your Honor, the deal was that Mr. Rucker was minority, obviously, and Mr. Rucker had the experience and the contacts. He did not have the capital or funding or equipment or money to fund the company himself. That is precisely why he went to Everin. He did his part of the deal. He did everything that he could do. He got his Series 65 license. He opened bank accounts. He created marketing materials. The agreement with respect to what Everin would do and what was understood they would do is demonstrated in Exhibit 31, because it's in writing, was never fulfilled. And I would like to make this analogy here. Suppose that there is a big difference between incorporating a company and supporting a company so that it can achieve the agreed upon objectives. Suppose that A has the contacts and expertise to get oil refining contracts and refine oil, but has no equipment and no capital with which to do so. B has the capital and the infrastructure to support an operating entity. B promises A that it will joint venture or partner with A to create an oil refining company, which will get oil refining contracts and refine oil. Oil Refining Corp is incorporated, and A is its president. Oil Refining Corp gets no capital, no equipment, no offices, and no employees. Oil Refining Corporation has no ability to get the contracts or refine oil. A sues B. B argues that the promises were fulfilled because Oil Refining Corp was incorporated and exists. Everin's argument is no different than B's in this case.
Counselor, presuming this court would agree with your positions here, how is this not error correction and nothing more?
I'm sorry? How is I didn't
presuming remember. That this court would agree with your scenario and your analysis, how is this not merely error correction on our part as opposed to anything else?
I'm not sure I understand your question, Your Honor.
Is there new law to be made here?
Yes. There can be. There are a number of ways that this court can decide this case. The court can decide that, can reaffirm its holdings in Klonowski.
Why would we need to
earlier.
Do that? That would just be error correction.
Well, that could be reaffirmance of principles that would be very important for the citizens of Ohio, since there is so much confusion with respect to the parole evidence rule. There is law with respect to merger clauses and the fact that they should not be automatically applied to bar a separate claim, which would bring Ohio squarely into conformance with the restatement, the United States Supreme Court, and courts throughout this country. Principles regarding the parole evidence rule are very important and affect businesses throughout the state. It's important that parties understand that they can have that and know that they can have successive separate contracts and that they are not going to be superseded or bound by a merger clause in the last contract when the parties never intended or agreed for that result to happen. Courts of appeal should not make those decisions sua sponte, and the face of the document test has been rejected. In fact, the defendants in this case never even made the arguments that the Court of Appeal that supported the Court of Appeal's conclusion. The defendants in this case argued that certain evidence should not have been admitted, and it's in their Court of Appeal's brief. The defendants argued that certain statements regarding the Chicago meeting should not have been admitted. And therefore, they asked for a new trial. They never argued that the entire claim was barred because of the parole evidence rule. The Court of Appeals simply reached that conclusion on its own.
But it didn't,
and one of the reasons
it didn't use the parole evidence rule to reverse.
Pardon me?
The Court of Appeals did not use the parole evidence rule to reverse, did it?
Well, As you wrote, I believe, Your Honor, the parole evidence rule is a the concept of integration and the parole evidence rule are corollaries to each other. So although it didn't use the words, I think that we can all agree that the concept and theories are the same. And as this court said, of course this court can also make law on concepts of integration and whether or not this court is going to follow the restatement and with respect to the trial court's determination to determine the intentions of the parties with respect to concepts of integration.
There apparently is no issue regarding the charge to the jury. Neither of you has raised an issue with respect to what the jury was charged on how it should decide the issues here. $2.2 million in verdict.
There's no issue on that.
It was not charged on promissory estoppel or on parole evidence. Well, parole evidence, I guess it wouldn't have been, but
there's no issue on that, Your Honor. Now, with respect, again, to the contract and why
you've used your time.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Karp.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May the court please. My professional colleague, Mrs. Simon, began our argument by saying the sole issue before this court is whether the Court of Appeals erred in invoking the parole evidence rule. I respectfully submit the Court of Appeals did not invoke the parole evidence rule. It didn't even mention the parole evidence rule. And rather, the issue before this court, now that it's here in a merit proceeding, is whether the Court of Appeals erred in holding that Rucker had failed to prove two necessary elements of his claim for promissory estoppel. The Court of Appeals held that he had failed in that regard in two respects. First, he had failed to prove that any of the promises that were made to him were unfulfilled. Second, he failed to prove that any alleged unfulfilled promise was a proximate cause of any damage. Those are two huge holes in the case.
Well, counsel, do you, was there agreement and is there agreement that establishing a minority business enterprise was part of the consideration that motivated Mr. Rucker to come with your client's firm?
Surely. No question about it. They did it.
And you maintain that, in fact, your client established the prerequisite minority business enterprise?
Well, let's put it this way, Judge Pfeiffer, Justice Pfeiffer, what the prerequisites are.
It's Pfeiffer.
Pfeiffer. What the prerequisites are is not clear from this record at all. All that was done was that this was to be a business that was owned or controlled by a minority. Mr. Rucker's an African American. He wholly owned it. He fully controlled it. It was his company. It was created with the assistance of Everett.
Do you dispute that if you were to try and land, for example, the 10% set aside that the Bureau of Workers' Compensation?
I'm sorry, would you start that again?
Do you dispute that if you were to try to land business, for example, with the Bureau of Workers' Compensation that has a 10% set aside, you have to have something more than a minority business in name only?
Surely.
That the state and others who have those set aside requirements are legally bound to make sure that it's not just a shell.
We're speaking hypothetically because we do not know what those requirements are. I would point out to the court, the only document anywhere in this record that has been ever referred to by the plaintiff in this case was a document, a memorandum issued by the Office of Administrative Services, the Ohio Department of Administrative Services, in April 1997, which is about 2 years after all this occurred, in which they set forth and said, if you come in and you are a minority enterprise, and if you are a joint venture, the following is applicable. Mr. Rucker's company was not a joint venture. He owned it entirely. For some reason, we get the implication reading that brief, he would have been better off, rather than owning it himself and being the sole owner, it would have been better off if he owned a minority interest in it and ever owned the rest. We didn't have that. He agreed it was not a joint venture.
Let me ask you a specific question.
So there's no requirements.
Was it established at trial that he had no secretary, no copy machines, no computers, no, that...
No.
There was no staffing.
No.
No back office.
My question...
For this...
I'm sorry, I'll let you finish your question.
For this enterprise.
Was that established at trial? To the contrary, he admitted he had all of that. If you look at pages 5 through 6 of our brief, we tick off in bullet points all of the testimony and all of the admissions as to what Everin provided him. They provided him with help with registration and documents. They gave him legal assistance. They provided him a private dedicated telephone line. They provided him office space. They provided separate signage and a separate entrance to his space. They provided a sales assistant. They provided him with staffing. They provided him with telephone support. They provided him with computer support. They provided him with investment consulting services. They provided him with back office support and expertise. They provided him with execution support. So my answer to my question is no, there was no such evidence. The evidence was to the contrary. They did everything for him. Unfortunately, he apparently was not willing to work. He expected things just to fall into his lap. He didn't go out and apply for things. He didn't do what he had to do to get the business. There wasn't a word anywhere in this record that any governmental agency or any private institution or any charitable endeavor refused to give Reggie Rucker money to invest because they didn't think he was a legitimate minority enterprise or that he was a front. There wasn't a word to that effect. Why didn't he get it? They turn around on us. You read their brief and say, defendants failed to explain why he didn't get the business. We say that is their burden of proof. Proximate cause is their burden, not ours. But if they want to know what the evidence showed, he didn't do the work. He didn't make the application. It's like the old joke, you know, about the individual who's standing on the waterfront, and he looks at the sky, and he imprecates God. He says, well, God, why haven't I won the lottery? I've been a good man. I've been devout. I've been loyal. I followed all your commandments. I go to church every Sunday. Why haven't I won the lottery? And finally, there's a flash of lightning, and the clouds part, and a voice from up above says, Dickinson, give me a break. Buy a ticket. And that's essentially what happened here. He didn't do the work. There is no proximate cause. The Court of Appeals squarely held that near the end of its opinion. I'm sorry.
Counsel, I presume this eloquent panoply of his deficiencies was presented to the jury.
Oh, I'm sure it was. And the jury didn't agree, but that's why we have appellate courts. The core point is, as the Court of Appeals stated rather eloquently, although Rucker maintained at trial that he was unable to receive minority set-aside funds from public entities because of the way RIC was structured, sole owner rather than being a joint venture, there was no evidence presented that RIC was denied any funds based on its improper structure. Rucker only speculated he was denied Ohio Workers' Compensation funds based on deficiencies in RIC's structure. He was not informed by the Bureau that this was the reason, and the evidence demonstrated that Rucker was 2 months late in submitting his bid. That's
Counsel,
the second. Yes.
This over here.
Yes, Justice Stratton.
The agreement that you have that is in evidence appears to be only an agreement as to your business investments with him, is that correct?
You're talking about the April 1996 agreement?
April 24th.
I'm sorry?
April 24th. There's an agreement that sets up the compensation, says you're not joint venture, has the integration clause. That agreement, as I read it, doesn't say anything about our business enterprise. It just seems to be strictly the relationship for regular investment clients. Is that correct?
The way it is read, there's certainly no, I find no reference in it to a minority business enterprise.
Was it intended to be just governing their business relationship as just an investor advisor that came over on an independent contract?
The way I read it is that it covered their entire business relationship because the fee structure that is involved in there, for example, encompassed what he was to get for these in this type of business as well. I think the split was to be 60-40% after 6 months.
So you believe that anything that the minority investment company got would have to share fees under this agreement?
Yes, oh yes, absolutely, 60-40. And the agreement itself specifically says it's not a joint venture. The relationship is to be that of independent contractor. They have characterized this as a compensation agreement throughout the proceeding. In fact, you know, it doesn't say it's a compensation agreement. We submit it covers their entire working relationship. But we further say, even if it didn't, even if you assume there were some promises out there that were not barred by this integration clause because they're limited only to compensation, if you say that, where are the promises? What was he ever promised? And he admitted he was promised they were going to help me create a minority business enterprise, which they did, which he held himself out to the world. His own literature says, I am a certified minority enterprise.
Counsel, you took me through this wonderful, it would be a beautiful closing argument to a jury. But you're here, and we're looking at why the Court of Appeals reversed this.
Yes.
And I find this paragraph on page 10 of their opinion. It says, therefore, the written contract precludes any claim by Rucker of promissory estoppel because any oral promises made to Rucker prior to entering into the written agreement cannot be considered. I think that one sentence seems to sum up what the Court of Appeals did. Ms. Simon has argued that she cited a lot of cases and the restatement, and you seem to avoid talking about that. I'm getting the same impression.
I would agree that the sentence that you've just read to me, Your Honor, summarizes the prior 10 pages of the opinion.
Right.
But the opinion doesn't end there. The opinion consists of 12 pages. If we look at the bottom of page 11 in the final paragraph, Your Honor, it says, furthermore, even if the integration clause did not apply, which is precisely the point I was just making to Justice Stratton, there is no indication that the promises were not fulfilled or that Rucker suffered any damage. The evidence indicates that Rucker Investment Consultants was created, the court can read it obviously as well, but it says was created and certified as a minority business enterprise. That's the only promise, and he fulfilled it. So we say, what does this discussion about parole evidence or even the integration clause have anything to do with it in view of the fact the promise that you rely on was fulfilled? Secondly, if it were not fulfilled, if somehow or other this minority business enterprise had to come equipped with certain bells and whistles that she's talking about, a separate building someplace, a wonderful entrance, thousands and thousands of dollars of support beyond what we're already, if you even had to have that, how did that cause him any damage? Where is there proof that somebody did not give them money? If a witness had come into that courtroom and said, you know, we would have given Rucker lots of money to manage, but we thought he was a front. We didn't think this was a legitimate business enterprise. That's something else again.
Let me test that with you. If Mr. Rucker was a sophisticated person in this business and understood the law and understood what it took to qualify, and he knew what he had to offer, in terms of what your client had set him up with, isn't it possible that he properly concludes this doesn't do it? I'm either going to have to lie to the people that I'm soliciting business from, or I have to stay away and not solicit the business until I have. What it would take to...
I suppose anything could have gone through the man's head. And if that went through his head, I would say, so why didn't you come to Everin and say, folks, this isn't working. I'm not getting the business. I'm going out and I'm talking to people and they're brushing me aside. Or they don't think I'm a minority business enterprise. This is what I need from you. There was no such evidence. This whole subject of promissory estoppel didn't arise until 5 years later when they filed in this lawsuit an amended complaint and said, promissory estoppel. It began as a discrimination case. You know, so why didn't anybody say something like that? We can't, obviously, in a court, we can't rely on speculation or assumptions or possibilities. Court of Appeals said, where's your proof? Where's your proof he didn't fulfill the promises that you say he made? Let's assume they were made, fine. Where is the proof? And secondly, where is the proof that this caused him any damage? They say, well, lots of money out there and available. True. There are lots of wonderful corporate clients available out there, but they're not coming to me unless I go and knock on their door. And it's the same sort of thing. It's his job to go there and make the effort. And if his effort is rebutted because of some failure on the part of Everett to fulfill his promise, he's got a claim. But that evidence is not in this case. I thank the court for its attention, and we respectfully urge the court to affirm the judgment of the Court of Appeals.
Thank you, Mr. Karp. Ms. Simon, you've gone well over your time, but you may take 30 seconds. You don't have to take it.
There were no deficiencies pointed out in the trial. Mr. Karp was not at the trial. There was no evidence that anything that Mr. Rucker failed to do with respect to his conduct, competency, efforts, et cetera, had anything to do with why he did not get the business. The evidence in the case was he did that. The contract that was entered into was one that he could not have gotten minority set aside terms under its under the structure. It would have been illegal to do so. All of the things that the defendants list over and over again that it gave to Mr. Rucker were things Mr. Rucker already had as an employee. So the contract in that regard would fail for want of consideration because it gave him nothing different than he already had. With respect to the damages in this case, the law is not proximate cause, for one. My understanding is that is a tort term. This is a contract case. And we submitted abundant evidence with respect to the damages in this case with competent testimony from which the jury could have reasonably reached a verdict. In addition, there was all sorts of evidence in this case from Mr. Forbes, from Felicia Flower Smith, from the defendant himself, Mr. Bain, and from Mr. Rucker, as to how the entity had to be structured in order to receive, and particularly from Felicia Flower Smith, how the entity had to be structured in order to get minority set-aside funds. The defendants agreed that it knew it had to be structured a certain way to get minority set-aside funds, and there was no evidence from anyone that any of that was done. Therefore, for the reasons we set forth previously, we request that the verdict be reinstated and the Court of Appeals be reversed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. The marshal, please adjourn the court.
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This open session of the Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio now stands adjourned.
Thank you.